This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I am Anki Nahasyan. What did James Madison mean when he wrote the Second Amendment? What was his motivation? In a new book, our guest says it was to quell slave rebellions, not to protect individual liberties. Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Current constitutional discourse places a privileged place on the thinking of the framers of the document. In other words, the understanding of the language at the time of the writing of the Constitution or an amendment should take precedence over more current interpretations of the language or the document. The scholarship in this field calls this school of thought originalism or framers' intent. So what did James Madison, author of the Second Amendment, mean when he wrote, and I quote, "A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed." On today's show, we explore this question in light of more traditionalist arguments, other arguments, with the author of a new book. The new book is entitled Madison's Militia. Carl T. Bogus is professor of law at Roger Williams University School of Law. He's the author of the book we are discussing today. The full title is Madison's Militia, The Hidden History of the Second Amendment. Just recently came out from Oxford University Press. He's also the editor of The Second Amendment in Law and History, Historians and Constitutional Scholars on the Right to Bear Arms, and the author of The Hard, Simple Truth About Gun Control and Gun Control in America's Cities, Public Policy and Politics. Professor Bogus, thank you very much for joining us today.
It's great to be back with you, Doug.
Thank you. And my first question is, ultimately, you're arguing that what's motivating the Second Amendment is actually quite different than the kind of traditional interpretation that it was about ensuring that a federal government could not infringe upon the liberties of individual citizens. What is your argument?
In a nutshell, this is my argument, that during the ratification debates, anti-federalists, particularly Patrick Henry and George Mason, accused to his face, accused James Madison of having written a constitution with the other, with his co-delegates at the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, having written a constitution that allowed Congress to disarm the state militias if they wished. Now, the militias had been, up to the Constitution coming into effect, instruments of the state government. The Constitution changed that and gave the lion's share of power over the militia to the National Congress. And Henry and Mason accused Madison of having written a constitution that permitted Congress to disarm the state militia if they wished to do that. And why would they wish to do that? And the kind of nefarious suggestion that was made was that the increasingly abolitionist North, which was growing faster than the South, would control Congress, that they did not have, Congress did not have the authority to abolish the slave system outright and would seek to undermine it by disarming the militia or doing other things with the militia. Removing them from the state was one of the possibilities that was raised, thereby leaving the South vulnerable to slave insurrection, because the Revolutionary War had demonstrated that the militia was ineffective as a military force, but it was absolutely essential to slave control in the South, and that to rectify this problem or this, whether it was a real problem or a paranoia on the part of Henry and Mason, it became a political problem for Madison. And to solve that problem, he wrote the Second Amendment to ensure that if Congress didn't arm the state militia could be armed anyway, because the people could do it.
Now, When I think about the Constitutional Convention, and I guess part of this is, you know, perhaps, you know, the Patrick Henrys and George Masons may have had a point about the federal government, was that what motivated the Constitution was the weakness of the Articles of Confederation, in part, you know, less about foreign intervention, country would be invaded, but much more about domestic insurrection. And specifically, the one that comes to mind is Shays' Rebellion, that, you know, this rebellion of Revolutionary War veterans using, you know, their power, their weapons to literally close banks to ensure that the banks could not foreclose on their farms, which they weren't able to pay for because they were off, you know, fighting a war. And that the fear, though the state of Massachusetts was able to put down the rebellion, the fear that what happens if a state couldn't. So I guess the question then is, wasn't the point of the Constitution to create a strong federal government in order to potentially even precisely do exactly what you were describing of weakening states if the states adopted a policy that the federal government didn't want?
Yes, I agree with everything you've said. The impetus for the Constitutional Convention was the weakness of the Articles of Confederation, where the national government was impotent, couldn't raise money for its own business. And so what the delegates did at Philadelphia was create a completely new structure with a far more potent national government. And that was the purpose for it. That's what why the delegates really exceeded their authority and did what they did. And you are quite right that Shays' Rebellion was forefront of their minds. So in 1786, 1787, you had this insurrection by former Revolutionary War veterans because of the monetary policy that Massachusetts employed, which favored creditors over debtors. We in Rhode Island, by the way, love this little piece of history because we favored debtors over creditors and didn't even join the union because we were afraid of kind of the Massachusetts policy. But the point is, there was an armed insurrection because people did not like government policy. And with one exception, the founders were alarmed. And their view was, hey, when there was a foreign occupying force here, British Army, and increasingly the colonists who were British subjects saw the British Army as an occupying force. And the founders said, it's really not our government because we don't have any representation in Parliament. And therefore, we can go to war against that occupying force. But they were completely of the view that you cannot take up arms against your own government. And that if you don't like government policy, the remedy, the constitutional remedies, you vote for different elected representatives and for different policies. The one exception, at least temporarily, at least for a while, was Thomas Jefferson, who wasn't around in the continental United States at the times of Shays' Rebellion. He was an ambassador to France. And he wrote a letter to Madison when he heard about Shays' Rebellion, and Jefferson was energized by it and said, the tree of liberty should be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots, or words to that effect. And Madison was horrified and wrote an excoriating letter back. And Jefferson's view was completely singular. I mean, everybody, all the other founders were, you cannot go to war with your own government. But they were worried about insurrections. They were very worried about it. In the South, the biggest fear of insurrections was slave insurrections. There were insurrections in other places. There was Shays Rebellion, and there were insurrections at other times in Pennsylvania and North Carolina. But that is what the Second Amendment was about, an armed militia so that the state could provide for its own security, not defense against invasion. That there was a motion when the Second Amendment was making its way through the first Congress to change security to defense, which was defeated. And that's what the concern was, a guarantee that there would be an armed militia so that the states could provide for their own internal security against insurrections, whether it's a Shays type rebellion, a whiskey type rebellion, or a slave or slave rebellions, which was a constant, perpetual concern in the South.
Now, wouldn't a large standing army be more effective at putting down these rebellions? Because, I mean, again, my understanding of Shays Rebellion was that the concern was, even though Massachusetts was successful at putting that down, it scared enough landowners to say, will they always be successful? So we may need a strong government, and by a strong government, large standing army that could actually put down those rebellions. And part of the inspiration for this question is you do go to detail in the book talking about just how ineffective militias were as fighting forces, particularly compared to the standing army. So why not use the standing army rather than militias?
But the militia was effective at slave control. And I think what we have to bear in mind here is slave control was not merely extinguishing insurrections when they arose, but preventing them. And so throughout the South, every night, the militia organized slave patrols where militiamen patrolled areas where there were slaves and plantations. And they went out at night and they checked to make sure that slaves were where they were supposed to be on their plantations, that they weren't going from one plantation to another, that they did not have contraband in their cabins, particularly weapons. And a standing army would have not been as effective as local militia who were from the area, knew the area, lived in the area, and could patrol every night. The amount of resources that the South devoted to slave patrol was enormous. And so these patrollers had beats, and they went out every night. And interestingly, the terms patrols and police beats come from these slave patrols that the militias organized. So the militia was effective at slave control. And it had in its biggest test, which was the Stono Rebellion in 1739, it was also successful at extinguishing an insurrection of some size. Because it was on the scene. It was there in the locality.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the original intent, James Madison's intent in the writing of the Second Amendment, with the author of a new book called Madison's Militia, Carl Bogus of Roger Williams University School of Law. So now with this question, with militia, now you're describing militia in a way, trying to understand the nature of this militia. You're really talking about policing. Right. So what's the relationship between, the militia being able to put down these sorts of rebellions and Stono's rebellion, which features, quite significantly, in this thinking, the militia versus just training a police, like a state police that could do, is that essentially the same thing, a militia and state police, or is there something different here?
It's similar. So one thing we have to bear in mind is there were no police forces at this period of time. There were no police forces in 1789. They hadn't really been invented yet. And so the militia in these patrols, these slave patrols, were doing a function that we might today think of as a police function. But You know, that's applying our contemporary thinking to their times. It was the organization they had at the time that was local, armed, and there to provide internal security.
Because what I'm thinking is the phrasing well-regulated militia, as opposed to the understanding that a bunch of citizens can get together, arm themselves, and call themselves a militia. That's not what's being the understanding of a militia, you know, of the 1780s.
So that well-regulated adjective is interesting. What happened, Doug, was earlier, as the colonies were moving towards revolution, were moving towards going to war with Britain and expelling Britain from, you know, the continental United States, there was a lot of hope for and praise heaped on the militia. After all, the colonies didn't have an army. And if they were going to take on a professional army, arguably the greatest in the world, or one of the two greatest in the world, France was also formidable, they really had to believe that the militia could take on the British Army and Navy. And there was a lot of talk about militia being superior because they were not professionals, they were more virtuous. Kind of the, you know, Cincinnatus leaving the plow and taking up, you know, arms. And the first battle at Lexington and Concord, the militia won. But that was the last battle they won too. And throughout the major engagements in the war, militia, which were not well trained, they were supposed to be well trained, but the states didn't bother to do it. And localities didn't bother to do it. And there were like annual musters. And, you know, it was kind of a time for camaraderie and drinking as much as anything else. The militia just did not have the training to go toe-to-toe with a professional army. And in the face of battle, they frequently threw down their weapons and fled, often before firing a single shot, and often even though they outnumbered the enemy. So by the time the first Congress assembled and Madison wrote his first draft of the Second Amendment and it made its way through into what, you know, what's become the Second Amendment, this well-regulated militia was quite a signal that we need a militia that is not only armed, but is trained and disciplined. Now, the Constitution had really left most of that up to Congress at that point. But it was nevertheless, nobody thought at the time that you just deputized yourself into a militia. The militia were government entities, state before the Constitution, and a dual state federal entity after the Constitution, but they were controlled, organized by and controlled by government.
So I want to dig into some of the narrative, some of the chronology, because the book centers rather directly, it starts off and spends a great deal of time in Virginia. So it seems like this discourse really was central to getting Virginia to ratify the Constitution. Why was it that Virginia became basically the linchpin that, you know, as Virginia went, it seemed like that's how the Constitution was going to go?
Great question. So when in the summer of 1787, the founders walked out of Independence Hall and said, we've written a new constitution and we've given you a republic if you can keep it. The new constitution required by its own terms that it be ratified by 9 states. If it was not ratified by 9 states, it would not come into effect. And states had to ratify through specially elected ratifying conventions. And Virginia called its ratifying convention, convened its ratifying convention in June of 1788, just about 1 year later. in Richmond. Now, this is a fascinating episode in American history for a couple of reasons. One, it's one of the most, I think, one of the most consequential, colorful, and dramatic incidents in American history, and also one of the least known. So 8 states had ratified, but it looked like if Virginia didn't ratify, there very well might not be a 9th state to ratify. Rhode Island, not a chance. They didn't even send delegates to the Constitutional Convention. They were not going to ratify. They thought New Hampshire was going to be an easy ratification, but they held a convention. They didn't have the votes, and they suspended the convention. New York seemed to be a non-starter. It was controlled by an anti-federalist governor, George Clinton, who was against ratification. And North Carolina looked unlikely. North Carolina might ratify if Virginia ratified, but looked like it wasn't going to ratify if Virginia didn't ratify. So it seemed to come down to Virginia. And beyond that, even if there were a 9th state and it wasn't Virginia, could you have a United States without Virginia? It was the largest state, the wealthiest state. It was the home to Washington, Jefferson, on, and Madison. And it was geographically in the middle. So everything seemed to come down to whether Virginia was going to ratify. And it was an epic battle. The anti-federalists who were against ratification, who did not want a strong national government, who did not want Virginia to give up power, were led by Patrick Henry, who had been the first governor of Virginia and was considered the greatest living orator in America. George Mason, who was a large slave owner, plantation owner, was considered the brains of the anti-federalists. James Monroe, an up-and-coming star who would later become president of the United States. And they're against the Federalists, led by James Madison, who was considered the principal architect of the Constitution. And John Marshall, who would become, you know, the most famous Chief Justice in history. George Washington was a Federalist, and he was not a delegate, but he was kind of offstage trying to help Edmund Randolph, who was the then sitting governor. And it was quite an epic battle, and nobody knew how it was going to turn out. And it was, and it lasted a month. And the other thing that is just so fortunate for us today, and this is highly unusual, we have an excellent transcript of it. It turned out that the shorthand reporter was like fabulous. It's not a perfect rendition, but it is way better than anything, than almost anything else we have of any other proceeding in the 18th century America. And so we have a lot, you know, pretty much verbatim about a lot of the debates that these guys had in that month in Richmond. And let's remember that this is in Eastern Virginia, where the majority population are enslaved blacks. And all of these guys that I've just mentioned were large slave owners, and they relied on the militia to keep them and their families alive. And so during these debates, when Patrick Henry and George Mason basically said, James Madison, you said you wrote a constitution that doesn't give the national government the power to abolish slavery. And we agree with you. It's not in that document. They don't have that power. But they're becoming increasingly abolitionist, and they will search that document for whatever power they have to eliminate slavery. And you have given them the tool, because in Article 1, Section 8, it says, Congress shall have the power to organize, arm, and discipline the militia. So Congress can organize the militia any way it wishes. It can arm the militia. It can discipline the militia, which is provide rules and regulations for the militia. And we, the states, the Constitution says, are left only with the power to appoint officers of the militia or train the militia in accordance with the discipline established by Congress. And when you said they have the power to arm the militia, that implies they have the power to disarm the militia. And that's what you've done. And it was calculated to strike terror into the minds of the delegates in Richmond in June of 1788. And it had to do that.
When we come back, how did the epic debate between James Madison of the Federalists and Patrick Henry of the Anti-Federalists frame the motivation behind the Second Amendment? Stay with us. Welcome back to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I am Anki Navasyan. The Constitution's ratification rested with the outcome of the Virginia Ratifying Convention. What were the debates and how were they resolved? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. On today's show, we're exploring the meaning, the framers' intent, the motivation of James Madison as he wrote the Second Amendment to the Constitution, what that means, what exactly is the framers' intent on the Second Amendment, and the role that militias played at ensuring a continuation of slavery, as well as the tension between state governments and the federal governments as embodied within the Constitution. Our guest today is Carl Bogan. He's a professor of law at Roger Williams University School of Law and has written a new book on this topic entitled Madison's Militia, The Hidden History of the Second Amendment. So Professor Bogus, you know, kind of continuing on this discourse, at the end of the day, it's clear that Virginia became a centerpiece in many ways because of the chronology, because of the way the states lined up, and because just the general power and the size, the economy, et cetera, of the state of Virginia. So how much is this argument that we need a Second Amendment really directed at Virginia and possibly North Carolina? It certainly looked like North Carolina's fate was tied to Virginia. So the fact that this was such an important issue to Virginia, was it also an important issue in the rest of the colonies?
It was at least as important, if not more so, to South Carolina. South Carolina had an even larger share of Black slaves to a higher ratio of Black slaves to whites than Virginia did. Had the same kind of the same geographic situation, which was in the East. It was very heavily, majority population was very heavily slave. Same thing in Virginia, in the Tidewater region, Eastern Virginia, it was majority Black. And then you got further west, it was less so. But where all of these guys lived, the enslaved population was large. So Madison didn't live in the Tidewater region, but the slave population was more than 40%. So the need for constant monitoring, patrolling of the slaves, and an armed force that could assemble in an instant to put down a slave insurrection was essential throughout the South. And by the way, there was slavery that was more northerly than we think of today. So Delaware had slavery and Maryland had slavery, and there was still slavery in New York. But all of the colonies, even the northern colonies, had, or states at this point, had concerns about insurrections, as you pointed out in, at the beginning of the show when the Shays Rebellion. So in the South, it was really focused on slave insurrections. But the North, too, was concerned about insurrections and having a force that could extinguish an insurrection if one arose.
Now, kind of delving into a little bit of a historiographical question then, is you spend a great deal of time reconstructing arguments, because again, you said the Richmond, the Virginia Ratification Conference has this, you know, remarkable record that isn't perfect, but quite impressive, you know, for that time. And as you're recreating those arguments, and we'll delve into some of the specifics in a moment, but what I noticed is the arguments about slavery, about maintaining slavery, about fears of slave uprising, et cetera, they're not actually in those arguments. You're making a number of inferences about the language. And I know this is something that proponents of a kind of traditionalist approach, that this was really about preservation of liberty against the federal government and not about slaves, you know, have critiques saying the word slavery is not in these debates. How comfortable are you at making these inferences as opposed to just sort of the historian's, you know, task, rely on the language that explicitly, and if it's not explicitly there, you don't have a smoking gun that where Patrick Henry says we have to protect the practice of slavery here. So how do you manage that question about inferences?
Right. So there are a couple of things, Doug, which is it's not, maybe the word slave or slavery isn't expressly mentioned. I'm not sure about that. But it is expressly alluded to several times by speakers on both sides. And one of the Federalists, and I can't remember right now whether it was Light Horse Harry or Edmund Randolph, at one point said, what happened was, I think it was George Mason who said, well, what happens if the federal government takes Georgia's militia and marches it to New Hampshire? What happens? Now, he didn't say if that were to occur, there's going to be a slave revolt. He didn't say that. I'll come back to why he didn't say it in a second. But he also didn't have to say it. Because what's the problem of taking Georgia's militia and marching it to New Hampshire? And they all understood there is no protection against slave revolts in Georgia. And so, suppose they do that. And one of, as I say, one of the Federalists says, and this is quite, you know, quite explicit, hey, if anybody needs the support of a militia from another state, it's not going to be New Hampshire needs Georgia's. It's going to be Georgia's needs New Hampshire's because of our condition. And what was their condition? Their condition is they had slaves. That's what it was. So there are a number of express allusions that are unmistakable to the fact of their concern about slave revolts. And as I pointed out, Henry did say, they're going to search the document to figure out how to get rid of slavery. He said that. So the second end of this, which is very interesting, is that there was a taboo about raising these issues too explicitly. They were committed to slavery. The whole economic system depended on slavery. And yet human beings can hold in their mind inconsistent thoughts at the same time. They were also embarrassed about it. And they were also afraid of giving slaves, they didn't want to give the North arguments about the slave system. And they didn't want to give slaves ideas about insurrections. So that one of the interesting things is the Stono Rebellion, 1739, Stono, South Carolina, very close to Charleston. That rebellion was reported in newspapers throughout the British realm. It was reported in Boston newspapers and New York newspapers and in London newspapers, but not in Charleston's newspaper. And why? They did not wish to give slaves ideas. Now, they had many ways of preventing slaves from having ideas, and one was it's a crime to teach slaves to read. We wish to keep slaves illiterate, but they knew all slaves weren't illiterate. So the conversation that happens at Richmond is completely the kind of conversation that happened at that time and place. And everybody understood what was being said, but they didn't say it too explicitly. Just like in the Constitution, there's a slave compromise that consists of five provisions, and the word slave does not appear.
Interesting. Now, I want to delve into the personalities also, because one of the more fascinating parts of the book was your description of Patrick Henry and his oration skill. And because you said certainly the convention is set up as this battle between these titans of Madison on one side and Patrick Henry on the other. And that Henry had been this extremely talented trial lawyer and yes, knew exactly how to move a jury, but made some interesting observations that he appealed much more to emotion than to logic. First of all, can you explain that? I want to make sure we talk about that. And then what was the implication of that as the debate, you know, carries out?
So that's exactly right. So Henry was largely a self-taught lawyer. Most of these guys had what we would today, you know, college education. Most of them went to what today is either William and Mary or Princeton or Columbia. But not Patrick Henry. He came from, his father was a judge. And his grandfather, I think, was a minister. He didn't have a shoddy education, but it was mostly through tutors. And kind of a self-taught lawyer, became a lawyer. There's some question about when he was admitted to the bar, he took an oral exam in front of three people about, you know, whether they kind of just passed him because of his family. And there's this story where he tries his first case, his first major case. And it has to do with compensation of ministers. And he takes the position that the ministers don't favor. And he gets up to make his closing address. And incidentally, one of the judges, he's arguing before, I think it was three judges, but several judges. One of them actually happens to be his father. A little unusual from 2023 conflict of interest perspective, but that's the case. And he stands up to make his closing oration, and it looks like he freezes. He looks to the heavens and no words come out. And everybody waits, and everybody waits. And it looks like no words are coming out. The kid, and he was young, first trial, is just immobile, frozen. And his father is feeling embarrassed and can't go on any longer. He's going to have to bang the gavel and move on. And just as he raises his hand to do that, Henry launches into a brilliant oration and wins the case. He was capable of making reasoned arguments in front of judges based on law, and he did that. And there are judges who attested to his acumen and ability to do that. But he was best known for making speeches to juries and eventually to political bodies. Give me liberty and give me death to Virginia legislature. So there is this one dramatic incident, which I think is very telling, where Henry says, you wrote this constitution that gives the federal government the power to arm the militia, which implies they have the power to disarm the militia. Nobody else can do that. And they'll use that to undermine the slave system. Now, he alludes to that. You're quite right. He doesn't say they'll do that to undermine the slave system. But I argue that the implication is inescapable of what he's saying. And Madison, who is brilliant and more technically astute than Henry, makes a mistake at this point. And Madison's actually not feeling well. He'd been out for a while. And Madison says, well, you know, the power's concurrent. I mean, come on. If the federal government doesn't, the national government doesn't arm our militia, we'll arm our own militia. And Henry just goes to town on him. And he ridicules him. And you can kind of almost, as you read the transcript, just kind of visualize it. And Henry says, oh, really? Oh, really? So you wrote this constitution that says Congress has the power to organize and arm the militia and provide discipline for the militia, and the state governments have the power to appoint the officers of the militia and to train the militia in the discipline established by Congress. And now you're telling us that doesn't mean anything. They both the national government, Congress, and the states have all the powers of all of it. You've parceled out these powers and it means nothing whatsoever. So we have the power to appoint officers, and I suppose so does Congress. And he just goes to town and just ridicules Madison. And it was one point, one place where Henry's right and Madison is just obviously wrong. And that had to sting. That had to sting. And although Madison ultimately prevails, that is, Madison and the Federalists prevail by the skin of their teeth, the key vote is 88 to 80. And nobody knew how it was going to come out until that vote was cast. Madison had been humiliated on that point. And then Henry wasn't finished. Henry does everything he can. And Henry is also not only a great orator, he's also the most politically powerful person in the state. He controlled the legislature. He comes up with a program to extinguish Madison's political career. He hates Madison. Madison is a nationalist. Henry is all power to Virginia. He wants to take Madison out of politics entirely. Henry arranges it so the Virginia legislature choose two other men to represent Virginia in the United States Senate, which is a kind of a blow to Madison, who was, you know, considered perhaps the greatest statesman. And therefore, Madison is reduced to running for a seat in the House of Representatives. And Henry comes up with a program to do two things. One, he recruits James Monroe, rising star, to run against Madison for that seat. And Henry redraws, gerrymanders the congressional district to pack in as many anti-federalist areas as possible to try to guarantee Madison will not get elected to the House of Representatives. And it's quite clear that Monroe is going to run on the platform of, I'm in favor of a Bill of Rights, and James Madison has opposed the Bill of Rights. And that Bill of Rights was popular. And that was the most popular argument the anti-federalists have. We want a Bill of Rights. And Madison did a lot of hand-wringing. You see this hand-wringing in letters to his friend Thomas Jefferson, who's away. What am I going to do about this? Madison says, I'm gonna flip. He rationalizes it to himself, and he says, he announces, I'm a campaign stump. I was opposed to a Bill of Rights before the Constitution was ratified. Now that the Constitution is ratified, I'm in favor of a Bill of Rights. And if you elect me, I will write one, and I will do my damnedest to get Congress to adopt it and propose it to the states. And he does get elected, and he goes to New York, where the first Congress convened. DC didn't exist yet. And when he gets there, nobody's interested in a Bill of Rights. The Federalists had opposed it, and both houses are overwhelmingly Federalist, overwhelmingly. There are a few scattered anti-Federalists in both chambers, very few, but it turns out they didn't really care about a Bill of Rights as much as they cared about using that as a tool to prevent ratification. And now they say, well, instead of Congress writing a Bill of Rights, why don't we have another constitutional convention? So they want to unwind the Constitution. That's not going to happen because they're very few and very weak. The Federalists are in control. But nobody's really interested in writing a Bill of Rights except now Madison, who had opposed one to fulfill his campaign promise to his constituents in Virginia. And it just makes perfect sense, Doug, that as he writes this Bill of Rights, he takes that opportunity to solve this problem, or this argument anyway, that he had been beaten over the head with in Richmond about Congress could disarm our militia.
So in essence, we get the Second Amendment as a part of this Bill of Rights, and this wording, you know, based on this fear of a slave insurrection. So is the basic argument here that we get the Second Amendment, we get this wording mostly for Madison's personal political fortunes, and it really is just directed at Henry and Virginia? Or is it directed much more broadly at the entire new nation?
Well, I don't think it was controversial. So I think that probably everyone thought, well, what a good idea. We all want an armed militia to provide for our own security. Massachusetts, we've had problems with Shays' Rebellion. You know, there had been problems in New Hampshire, problems in Pennsylvania, problems in North Carolina with various insurrections that weren't slave insurrections. Certainly the Stono Rebellion, the slave insurrection in South Carolina. And so I don't think it was controversial. You know, it seemed like a good idea at the time kind of thing. And it had a pedigree that comes from the English Bill of Rights of exactly 100 years earlier, of 1689. There was a right to keep arms provision in the British Constitution, which sounds, when you first read it, like it's an individual right to own weapons. But when you understand the history, you understand it wasn't that either. So I don't have it right in front of me, but it's something like the subjects who are Protestant may have arms suitable to their condition and as allowed by law. And that's the original right to have arms provision. That's where everything first originates from. And what was that about? Well, it wasn't about that individuals in Britain could have arms if the government didn't want them to. It was all about who got to determine what arms Brits could have or Protestants could have. Nobody cared about Catholics having arms. And in fact, when that was written, the mayor of London was disarming Catholics, and everybody thought Catholics ought to be disarmed at that particular moment. As allowed by law, what that meant was Parliament decides what arms subjects who are Protestant may have. And it was a struggle. The what led up to that was a struggle between the crown and Parliament over who got to make that choice. And in the Glorious Revolution, when Parliament basically offered the crown to William of Orange and his wife Mary, and negotiated under what terms they would accept the crown, the entire English Bill of Rights was about protecting Parliament's right to make the law. And the king had to acknowledge that. So that is what that was about. And by the way, suitable to their condition was Parliament had historically, actually for a couple of centuries, conditioned what arms, who could have arms and what arms they could have on their social status. And basically, only 2% of the English population could have arms. Somebody said, some wag said, it was that this provision in the English Bill of Rights was all about, and the English system of gun regulation was all about protecting peasants, protecting pheasants from peasants. They did not want the aristocrats, the lords and dukes and earls did not, and marquises did not want peasants hunting on their land.
Okay.
So
we have about 2 minutes left, and I want to make sure to get this last question, you know, observations. We started off talking about originalism and framers' intent as our understanding for what is the meaning of the Second Amendment. Your observations from your history, what can we draw from that in our own understanding of what the Second Amendment, what Madison meant by the Second Amendment, and what the Second Amendment should mean in 2023?
Well, what it should mean is that the states, regardless of what Congress decides, the states have some minimum right to an armed militia to provide for their own security. So in 2023, if there are riots, if there are natural disasters, the governor can call up the National Guard, and the National Guard will be armed, and that the states have some minimum right to that, even if Congress were to decide that they didn't. And the amendment has been interpreted at various times that way. So I don't think it is obsolete under that interpretation. Now, you know, I have to say the Supreme Court has decided that isn't what it means. The Supreme Court has decided that a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, means that it has nothing to do with a militia and has everything to do with providing individuals the right to have guns for their own self-protection. How these textualists come up with that is maybe a story for another episode, and I would say quite tortured, but I think that any fair reader of the Second Amendment is going to have to say it's definitely connected to the militia and to the security of the state. That's the way it ought to be interpreted today. Not the way it is interpreted.
Right. And it also suggests to me that a lot of times when we have this discourse about original intent, understanding exactly what the framers wanted is less the interest of the jurist who's making this decision on a constitutional interpretation, but instead that they have an outcome in mind that they like to get to, and then go through history to find the information necessary to back what would be an originalist, you know, intent. So in essence, and that's the nature of historical memory, using history for your own contemporary political purposes, as opposed to delving into what the actual historical record might be. It's more of a tool rather than a guide to the, to whatever the judicial outcome might be. And this, of course, you know, your book, along with a number of other works out there that have been wrestling with precisely this question, just elevates the question about what original intent might, you know, might mean. We've been discussing the origins of the Second Amendment, what James Madison actually meant and what motivated him when he wrote a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. That is the Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. And our guest today has been Carl Bogus, professor of law at Roger Williams University School of Law. He's the author of a new book that has just come out in 2023, published by Oxford University Press. The title of it is Madison's Militia, The Hidden History of the Second Amendment. He's also the editor of the Second Amendment in Law and History, Historians and Constitutional Scholars on the Right to Bear Arms, and the author of The Hard Simple Truth About Gun Control and Gun Control in America's Cities, Public Policy and Politics. Professor Bogus, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Doug. I enjoyed our conversation.
I'd like to give a special thanks to the Scholar Circle team, Maria Armudian, host and anchor, Ankine Agassian, and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongri, webmaster and production assistant,
and Mahika Chechi is our intern.
All Scholar Circle shows are archived on scholarcircle.org. You can find our podcast on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle Twitter account, and please join our Facebook page. On behalf of the Scholar Circle team, I am Doug Becker. Thank you for listening.